This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. This past Thanksgiving, President Obama set aside his agenda on immigration to take part in an annual holiday tradition.
To spare the lives of two turkeys, Mac and Cheese, from a terrible and delicious fate.
It should come as no surprise that the president's daughters, Malia and Sasha, who were there with their dad, found this whole charade just as cheesy as the rest of us. And yet after the event, they were critiqued by some as looking like bored, disinterested teenagers. One particularly nasty Facebook comment went viral, and the internet hasn't been able to stop talking about it since. Now, anybody who remembers the exploits of the Bush twins less than a decade ago knows that gossiping about presidential progeny is nothing new. But as it turns out, the practice is as old as the White House. Jamie Fuller writes about politics for The Washington Post, where you'll find her article, The Long and Fraught History of Judging the President's Kids. And Jamie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, great to be on.
So you combed through the archives sort of looking for historic examples of presidential kids in the news. What was the earliest case you were able to find?
Well, in fact, there are many people who would argue that the Lincoln boys were the worst presidential kids of all. People who went to the White House were always terrified that they'd have to deal with these kids who would play pranks on everyone. And you can find lots of instances of people writing in their diaries when they got home, like, it was great meeting the president, but those kids, they get away with everything.
And in fact, you have a bit of news clip here. It has somebody quoted as saying, had they expletive deleted in Lincoln's hat and rubbed it on his boots, he would have laughed and thought it was smart.
Yes. So I think the bar is pretty high for being a bad presidential kid.
Well, and it sounds like expectations were really different back then. So, you know, obviously this was long before TV, but do you think the political culture regarding the president's families was different too?
Oh, definitely. And you have the same thing with James Garfield, too. His kids were called Holy Terrors, and you can kind of sense the amusement that the country had about it. And there was very much, it felt kind of like a royal sense where people kind of loved the family and enjoyed watching them like their own. And now there's so much media that needs to be fed into all the time. It's kind of, there's a frustration that we don't hear much about the presidential kids. At the same time, the presidential families are being far more private with their kids, knowing that the media that they're going to have to deal with is far more than the Lincolns would have had to deal with.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the reasons the internet so vigorously defended the Obama girls is that, you know, these are people that aren't seeking the limelight. They don't have a choice about whether or not to be members of the first family. But you did write about one presidential daughter in your article who actually loved that sort of attention, Alice Roosevelt. What was her story?
She was a character, and people have been writing about her for so long because she did amazingly interesting things. And she was Teddy Roosevelt's child by his first wife, who died. And she always felt kind of apart from the rest of the family. And the way she dealt with that is by doing lots of pranks and kind of messing around. And she would always carry a snake around with her to parties, and the newspapers would cover it in like humongous headlines like, oh my goodness, there's a snake at the White House. And when McKinley died, she said that she experienced sheer rapture when it happened, which you can't even imagine anyone saying in those circumstances today. And she was just known as kind of the party child.
I can't imagine what that tweet would look like and how that would go over.
Yeah, no, exactly. And nowadays, before Malia and Sasha, you've like, Teddy Roosevelt kind of was like, whatever. Like, he was kind of frustrated that his daughter was going to overshadow him on the front of the newspaper with her antics when he was doing important things, too. But he would never kind of shush the press in the way that the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas have.
Well, yeah, I grew up during the Clinton era, and I always had this sense that regardless of whether or not the press always followed it, that the president's daughter, that Chelsea was off limits. So when did that become a thing?
If you pay attention, you can kind of feel it happening with the start of the 24-hour news cycle. And when CNN became a thing, that was kind of when the president kind of shoved his family back into the house. And one thing you'll have with Chelsea Clinton is she was far younger than a lot of other presidential children who had been in the White House. And you see the same thing happening with Malia and Sasha, where they're so young that that's part of the protectiveness, even on top of the news cycle.
It's funny, when I was reading through your article, I realized that there's a difference, too, in how the president and the family has reacted. So when People magazine featured Chelsea in 99 on their cover, the Clintons put out just a very stiff statement sort of denouncing the decision, saying it was a regretful move on people's part. But in 1950, President Truman had a very different reaction to criticism of his daughter, Margaret. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, no. Margaret was trying to become a famous singer, and she would often perform in places that you could never imagine performing at that age unless your father happened to be the president. And a Washington Post critic kind of slammed her performance and saying she had a long way to go, and just went on and on and on with the criticism. And when Truman saw that, he wrote a letter to the critic saying, like, threatening him and saying, you better watch out, I'm coming for you if you do this again.
Yeah, he threatened to beat him up.
Yes. And you can't imagine anyone doing that today. And I think another reason that there's a new edge when people talk about presidential kids that wasn't there 50 or 100 years ago is there's a sense that the whole presidential family has become a partisan matter, and that people see the family as an extension of the president. And if they don't like the president, they see everything as fair game. And I don't think that was there in the same way 50 or 100 years ago.
Well, you're a political reporter. When do you think, if ever, a president's kids should be considered fair game for the media?
I think there's kind of been a sense honed in over the years that when there's governmental matters at stake, when there's legal issues at stake, you're welcome to talk about the presidential kids. And that's kind of why people talked about the Bush twins when they got in trouble in Texas over liquor laws. It's like, we're allowed to talk about this. Something's happened. But I think that's kind of been the rule that's set in, is when there's something else going on, like, write about it. But if it's personal issues, if it's anything small like that, stay back. And I'm sure it's going to keep changing as the media keeps ramping up. And so we'll see what happens. We'll see if it kind of extends into, at what point are we going to start talking about congressional kids, too? Will we ever be at that point?
Oh, I don't know. There's just too many of them, though.
Exactly.
Jamie Fuller writes about politics for The Washington Post. You can read her article, The Long and Fraught History of Judging the President's Kids, at wordofmouthradio.org. And Jamie, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Of course.
While some presidents were brought into the limelight because of the antics of their children, others have made a reputation for themselves through their very own bad behavior. Nate DeMayo of the Memory Palace brings us the sad story of one such president near and dear to New Hampshire.
Franklin Pierce was the Mac. He was handsome, he was rich, he was connected. His dad was the governor of New Hampshire. He's in the state legislature at 24, in Congress before he's 30. When he's there, he does Washington up. Early 19th century style, going to all the right parties, flirting chastely with senators' daughters, debating Aeschylus or the Magna Carta or whatever until dawn, and drinking all the time. All the time. He gets a reputation, and he starts to feel terribly about it, and just generally terrible. He's a loud drunk. He's always hungover. He tells a friend he needs to stop, straighten up his act. The friend sets him up with a woman named Jane Appleton, a minister's daughter. She's shy and frail and devout, and Franklin figures that she's just the kind of person he needs to save him from himself. Jane hates D.C. She hates the parties. She doesn't trust her husband's friends, his old drinking buddies. She keeps telling him to quit politics. He's a senator by now. Move away from this awful place and its bad influences and its booze. And he does. And they head back to New Hampshire and focus on raising their sons. For a while. He goes off to the Mexican-American War. While Franklin's away, Jane gets depressed and throws herself into her Bible and the temperance movement. And while Franklin's away, he throws himself back into his drinking. He comes back home a war hero, at a time when that sort of thing gets a man nominated for president. Jane doesn't want any of it. She's convinced that if Franklin goes back to Washington, he'll spiral out of control. She starts having visions that tell her terrible things will happen to their family if he runs. They'd already lost two of their three sons to illness. Shouldn't tempt God. But he does. And he wins the election. And Jane is despondent. This is a bad idea. Right before the inauguration, Franklin and Jane and their 11-year-old son Benny take a train trip to attend a funeral of a friend. They get out at one of the stops to stretch their legs, and there's an accident. The train decouples, and one of the cars rolls away. Their son is crushed beneath it. Jane is convinced that Benny's death is a sign. God doesn't want her husband to be president. And right there on the train platform, she refuses to come to Washington with him, and she goes home. He leaves a few days later. He's inaugurated, alone. His last remaining son has just died. His wife is convinced that it's his fault. He's sad and alone. And without Jane to look out for him, he starts hanging out with the boys and drinking. All the time. Spiraling. It takes him 2 years to convince the First Lady to come down to Washington in a last-ditch effort to save him from himself. She spends the rest of his administration upstairs in the White House, alone in a room at the end of the hall, writing heartbreaking letters to her dead son. Soon after they return to New Hampshire, Jane Pierce dies of TB. Soon after that, Franklin Pierce dies of a corroded liver. Also, as a president, he totally sucked.
That story came to us from Nate DeMayo of the Memory Palace. Coming up, from encrypted apps to password protection, we go to great lengths to protect ourselves from hackers. But is free wireless internet making it easier for them to get to our personal information? The frightening reality behind public Wi-Fi hotspots when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. These days, just about every coffee shop, bookstore, and restaurant touts a free Wi-Fi hotspot as a perk of being a customer. It is so convenient that in many cases, you don't even need to sign into the network. Your phone just connects you automatically. But as is often the case with technology, free Wi-Fi comes at a substantial price: your digital security. Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at Zero Coal and our Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. And Rob, it's always nice to have you in the studio.
Great to be here, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. How do Wi-Fi hotspots actually work when you're using them in public places?
Well, you have to think about a Wi-Fi hotspot as your internet connection when you're at home. So when you're at home, you have your computer plugged in or connected via wireless network to your local network and perhaps through your cable modem or DSL modem out to the internet. And the thing that's nice about having your connectivity at home is it's just like your house. Your house has a front door. It has walls. It has windows. Those things protect you.
Sure.
Just like your cable modem and your DSL modem at home protect you. For example, me in my home, I can't necessarily connect to the devices in your home because I'd have to go through your cable modem or Wi-Fi router that is provisioned by either you or your internet provider. There are things in there that do filtering and firewalling to prevent out bad traffic. But when you bring your device, your laptop, your phone, to a Wi-Fi hotspot, your device doesn't know that it's not at home, connects to the internet, and away you go. The difference is that when you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, it's kind of like inviting a whole bunch of people you don't know into your home and letting them plug into your network. The guy at the table next door in Starbucks, he's, you know, a peer of yours now. It's like his computer is plugged into your home network.
And you made a good point. You know, your phone will just automatically connect to a hotspot when I'm visiting a new place. Now, how does that happen, or is that a dangerous thing?
It's actually a very dangerous thing. I'm really saddened that almost all of our devices do that automatically. Let me give you an example. Very common hotspot names might be things like a wireless carrier like AT&T or Verizon or Starbucks.
Right.
Or free Wi-Fi. You know, there are all those things that you see and you know, you say, oh, wow, this is great. I'll connect to that. And then what happens is your phone remembers that. says, ah, or your computer remembers that. Says, oh, I remember ATT. That's a free Wi-Fi. And if I see it with that name, I'll just automatically connect to it. And if it has no password, boom, I'm online. So let's say, for example, I'm a bad guy. I might sit in the airport and create a hotspot with the name AT&T. And as you walk by, your phone will just say, oh, wow, look at that. Your phone's sitting in your pocket.
Just because of the name?
Just because the name matches something it used to connect to. So boom, it'll automatically connect. And there you go. I'll be connected to you just like a peer.
Okay, so say this happens. Now I'm connected to a hotspot created by a bad guy, a hacker.
That's correct.
What can he do from there?
Well, there are two things that are interesting. First of all, once he's connected to you, there's generally no firewall between you. So he can probe your device. He can try and see what's going on your device. In addition, he can watch your traffic. So let's say your device goes out and, you know, pings your email provider or website or some app is running. He can watch that traffic and snoop it. So if any of that traffic isn't completely encrypted, the bad guy can watch and see everything you do. And finally, and the worst thing is that really malicious people can create fake versions of known websites. So for example, let's say I create my own Wi-Fi hotspot and you connect.
Okay.
And you say, I want to go to Google. Well, I can say, oh, look, Taylor's phone is asking for Google. I won't send that off to the real Google. I'll respond like I'm Google. And then Taylor's talking to my computer, not the real Google computer.
So he'd reroute me to a page that he created.
That's correct.
And maybe that could be, you know, a login for a bank account.
Exactly.
Or that could be anything.
It could be anything. That's okay. The real problem. You might be tricked into logging in, giving your account credentials. Now, there are a lot of the banking sites, if you'll notice, have things, you know, you type your username and then it comes back with some picture that maybe you pre-configured. And
yes.
Those are terrific. I know all my banking sites do that. And you got to watch for that because a guy who's spoofing, he wouldn't know that, you know, Taylor Quimby has a picture of puppies that comes up when he types his username in.
How did you know it was puppies?
Well, you know, you're just kind of puppy guy. But there are a lot of protections to do that, but not everyone sees that. And nobody really sees that if they're inside of an app, right? The apps are doing connections behind the scenes. So there are pretty much three scary things that can happen when you connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot. The first thing is you're not behind a firewall. So your device, your computer can be probed by all the people that are in the hotspot. The second thing is traffic snooping. If you connect to a hotspot and it's being put out by someone who's evil, they can look at all of your data up and down the internet. And then the third thing is they can fake websites that you might be going to or any type of destination.
Now, are we talking about, say, this theoretical hacker, are we talking about somebody who is like top of the line hacker, like there's really only, you know, a handful of these master spy hackers out there? Are we talking about anybody who does a little research online, can afford the equipment by themselves? I'm like, where's the status of this hacker?
Sadly, the status is going down. I'd say a few years ago, you're talking about people who are quite sophisticated. But now the tools are getting easier and easier to find. So being able to set up your own Wi-Fi hotspot and snoop all those packets, that's pretty easy. I mean, you could do some Googling and figure out how to do that. So the bar to getting into this business is getting lower.
Well, if that's the case, then we need to come up with a way to protect ourselves. So what should we be doing differently, assuming that we don't want to completely avoid using Wi-Fi in public places at all?
The first thing I would do is in almost all your devices, there's an ask to join icon that comes up when you first connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot. And you want to enable that. What I mean by that is when your computer or your phone sees a network it wants to connect to, it should pop up a dialog box and say, hey, Taylor, do you want me to connect to this? Now, you're sitting in Starbucks and all of a sudden it says T-Mobile or AT&T. You want to say, geez, is this a T-Mobile or AT&T place? Do I want to connect to that? It just gets you involved so it doesn't automatically connect to something that might be bad.
So opt-in rather than automatic.
Exactly. The second thing I would do is occasionally, and I do this myself, clear all the Wi-Fi hotspots in your computer or phone. And that can be done through the network settings. You know, it's reset network settings and it'll clear all the known hotspots because, you know, you might have hundreds, thousands listed there. And some of them might be auto-connect. So I'd recommend you do that. From then on, you'll be obviously prompted for anything new. And then the third thing is be very careful about accessing sensitive places from free Wi-Fi hotspots, especially passwordless. So for example, if you're going to log in and do banking, probably not good to do that from the free hotspot in the airport.
Okay, so all that makes sense to me. But I have to admit, there's this funny thing when we talk about the dangers of using something like public Wi-Fi for me, because in a sense, there's this feeling that, well, there's dangers everywhere. You know, somebody could rob my house at any given point. And yes, I lock the door, but I don't have a, you know, a fancy security system. And the same with my phone. There's this hope for me that there's so many people out there that the convenience of maybe getting to use something like public Wi-Fi outweighs the dangers in the sense that I just might luck out and not be targeted.
Well, let me give you a little bit of ease.
Okay, good.
The bad news is that bad guys are out there. They're being sponsored by countries and companies now. So there are serious people out there. So that's bad. The good news is that we all view the utility of this, and the good guys are coming up with better and better defenses. For example, what I mentioned before about showing images, and there are other two-factor authentication logins. So more and more, at least important sites, are requiring higher levels of security than just logging in with the app. But you have to be aware of it. I mean, you can't just, you know, if somebody puts up, hey, you know, here's Bank of America, and you just don't pay attention, don't look for the locked icon, the security icon, well, you know, they're probably going to trick you.
Well, Rob, thank you for both scaring me and reassuring me. I appreciate it.
It's a dangerous world out there, Taylor.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at ZeroCol and our Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. We've got Rob's tips for safe surfing at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Been looking for the... All I ever really wanted was Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi.
All right. Anyway, from Minute Maid to Tropicana, Florida Natural to Dole, each brand of orange juice has a very distinct flavor. But how does the industry achieve such consistent flavor if all that juice is coming from the same oranges? We'll find out when Word of Mouth continues.
This ain't nothing in life free, but what about Wi-Fi? All dogs go to heaven, right?
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Now, I'm a coffee guy, personally, but some mornings nothing beats a tall glass of 100% orange juice. Pure and refreshing as it may be, though, you might be surprised to discover that there's a trade secret behind getting your orange juice to taste especially orange juicy. And while the product may technically be all natural, the process itself is another matter. Clay Wirestone is a contributor to Mental Floss, where he wrote about two semi-secret industry additives, one for orange juice and another for wine. And Clay, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here, Taylor.
So I've always heard that you should be careful of taking natural for granted when you read it in a food label. Is that the case?
That's certainly part of the situation with orange juice. You know, the thing is, the old frozen orange juice in tubes, believe it or not, is probably one of the most natural kinds of orange juice that you can buy, because they pick the oranges, they, you know, pulp them, or they get the juice out of them. The water's taken out and it's frozen. And that was done for a few decades, and that's actually a fairly simple natural process. But what happened was is that in the 80s or so, the big juice manufacturers realized that they could maybe market something a little bit differently, maybe make something a little more appealing by launching what they called, you know, not from concentrate orange juices.
Right.
And the key point here is that they're called not from concentrate. They are not called fresh. And that's because they're not. You know, oranges are really only harvested 2 or 3 months out of the year.
Right.
So in order to have a consistent kind of supply of not from concentrate juice, you have to store it. And what they figured out in terms of storing it was you'd take the juice and you would put it in giant vats. Or juice would then be in for about a year. But to keep the juice from going bad or oxidizing, they had to take out all the oxygen.
Okay.
What happens when you take out all the oxygen is that you take out most of the flavor.
That sounds like a problem.
Yes. Or the volatile organic compounds that make things smell and taste good, since so much of taste is smell. So what they figured out, and they kind of got with some of the scent and flavor scientists. You know, there's a lot of them in New Jersey for some reason. But these are also folks that do perfumes and the flavorings that are added in other foods.
So I hope you're not about to tell me that there's perfume in my orange juice.
No, well, it actually is. I mean, it's basically an orange flavored perfume. Yes. I mean, if you think about it, so much of taste, I mean, taste is very simple. Like, taste is sweet, sour, salty, whatever.
Okay.
What we think of as taste is so much of it is actually smell. So what these flavor scientists did was they figured, well, you know, it's going to look weird if orange juice has, you know, added flavorings on the label.
Well, you couldn't call it 100% juice.
Exactly. So what they did was they gave the flavor scientist the assignment, well, here is some orange peel, some orange oils. You know, in other words, all stuff that's actually extracted from oranges. But now do your magic on it. And so, you know, kind of using these as starting points then, the scientists put together what became known as flavor packs. And these these flavor packs are...
So it sounds like Kool-Aid.
Yeah, more or less. And so then what you do is you'd go into this giant refrigerated vat of orange juice. You'd take out, you know, the juice for the day, and you'd add these flavor packs back in. And it gives you a consistency, too. I mean, that's the other big point here is that, you know, you could theoretically have orange juice without flavor packs, you know, if you didn't deoxygenate it, whatever. But it would all taste different. And people want certain things. You know, people have, you know, a Minute Maid. I like Minute Maid because it tastes like this. I like Tropicana because it tastes like this. And to ensure that consistency, basically, that's one of the reasons that flavor packs, you know, came into being. I mean, the other thing that's important, as I note in my article, you know, the two leading brands of orange juice, Minute Maid, Tropicana, one's owned by Coke, one's owned by Pepsi. So it's not like the owners of these brands have any kind of special all-natural inclination. You know, these are big multinational brands that want to keep things consistent.
Wait, so are there different flavor packs for different brands? Or
yes,
is it one
yes.
thing
no,
that gets
no,
put
no,
in
no,
all orange
each,
juice?
It's actually not only by different brands. It varies by country as well. People in the United States have a slightly different preference for how their orange juice tastes than people in other countries. Minute Maid has one of the most distinctive flavor packs, apparently. It's a kind of a candy flavor, very sweet.
That's exactly how I love my orange juice.
and actually, I mean, folks that have looked into this say that one of the most interesting things about flavor packs is they don't actually make it taste like orange juice. Like, actual orange juice does not taste like flavor-packed orange juice. It is not as sweet. It is not a but because people have certain flavor preferences in their palates, over the years they formulated these flavor packs to, you know, to kind of be what people want and what people think of as orange juice. But it's not actually necessarily what it is.
Okay. Well, it's kind of weird, but overall not harmful, right? We don't have to worry about this.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not and actually in the orange juice industry, I mean, it's kind of an open secret. I mean, when you have these giant publicly traded companies, these things don't remain, you know, off the radar totally. And it is true. I mean, it is made from oranges. So they're able to say quite accurately it's 100% orange juice. It's more just, if you think about it, we have these kinds of industrial food production processes. And, you know, people want to know what's behind that.
Okay, well, then let's move to wine, because you also wrote about wine. Mm-hmm. And winemakers are using something that I guess might be considered similar to flavor packs, except it sounds even more like Kool-Aid. We're talking about a product called Mega Purple,
Mega Red.
Ultra Red.
Ultra
Mega Purple,
red, yeah.
Ultra Red.
Yes. Well, so the thing about wine is it's actually much more secret or it's much more under the radar because, you know, wine is generally created by much smaller companies, you know, and a little more family kind of oriented business. They don't have to be quite as public about what goes on.
And we like to think of it as coming from a certain region and being very, you know, there's a local quality
right.
to wine.
Yes, except for the fact that we also like things to be cheap. I mean, obviously, some people do want to go out and buy the $50 bottle or whatever, but that's a relatively rare occurrence. So if you think about it, though, you know, wine faces a similar problem, which is, you know, certainly in the United States, more and more people like wine. There's the notion that it's good for your health if you're drinking your glass of red wine a day. So you have to make a lot of wine. And again, wine is very variable based on the year. And people have certain things they want to see in wine, particularly your red wines. They want to see it be dark. They want to have it have a real, you know, kind of a fruity aroma and taste. And so that's what Mega Purple, Ultra Red provide. These are essentially super concentrated. It's a super concentrated grape juice.
Mm-hmm.
It sells for around $130 a gallon. And they basically put just, you can literally just put a few drops or so. It's you know, it's less than 1% of a bottle of wine. It's sometimes like 0.4 or something like that.
But it must have a pretty powerful effect.
Well, exactly.
It's ultra
concentrated. And according to some estimates, it's in basically every bottle of wine that's sold under $20. But at the same time, there's a little bit of dispute in the wine world about it. Because, again, you know, you're talking about something that, you know, what's wine made of? It's made of grapes. What's mega purple or ultra red? It's grapes. It's, you know, it's concentrated grapes. And this is actually not a new problem for wine producers. You know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, there would always be an issue that you would get an off year. You'd get a bad crop or, you know, the wine would look a little weird. It maybe taste a little funny. And so, you know, in old time, you know, older days, what they would often do is you'd actually just blend another complementary kind of wine in it. Again, I think it's our perception of what a product is, which especially is wine, which I like to think people I think like to think that, you know, it's just kind of squished with your feet and it's put in a bottle and it's put away in a vault. And, you know, 2 or 3 years later, there it is.
So this was news to me when I first read your article. Is this on a label anywhere? Are consumers going to actually read about this when they're buying a product if they wanted to?
No, and that's because, you know, kind of as we've mentioned, with a flavor pack from orange juice, because those starting ingredients are from an orange, even if they're manipulated in a lab, it's still 100%, you know, orange sourced. And it's true. I mean, that's where it starts from. And in, you know, similarly, when you're talking about mega purple and the ultra reds, you know, again, even though these are hyper concentrated in, you know, it's kind of a product of some lab trickery or whatnot, because they're starting from a grape, it's still wine. It's not something that's required to be labeled, you know, as a separate ingredient.
So after discovering this, your thoughts, should we avoid these additives or accept them as maybe a necessary part of wanting our beverages to taste more or less the same all the time?
I mean, I think in a way it's a triumph of – there's a weird kind of triumph of modern food production there. You know, there's a giant demand for these products. There's a giant demand for them to taste good and consistent. And this is actually food producers reacting to market forces. And certainly, you know, if you're talking about orange juice, you can always buy some oranges and, you know, and squeeze them yourself at home. It is not difficult to make a natural orange juice. And it's certainly not difficult to go out and spend a lot more on a bottle of wine if you want. And you'll probably at that point have something that's, you know, if you're buying something that's, you know, $30, $40, $50, it's probably going to have a you know, a little less monkeying around with it.
Well, Clay, thanks for adding a flavor pack to our show today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Clay Wirestone is a contributor to Mental Floss. You can find a link to his article on flavor packs and Mega Purple. And no, we're not talking about Kool-Aid. You can find that link at wordofmouthradio.org.
From Florida, a powerhouse of vitamin C, Florida Orange Juice gives Barbara Ann Scott, Olympic skating champion, a real powerhouse of vitamin C and energy.
Yes, that's true. I know I need vitamin C every day because I've been told the body just cannot store it. And I like to get my vitamin C the way nature
intended. Aside from the flavor, one thing that greatly influences our food purchasing habits is, of course, packaging. William Hammack brings us this story of a man who had a special gift for packaging, Gale Borden.
In this gift-buying season, you can study a sub-discipline of engineering that fascinates me, packaging. A good package blends technical know-how and psychology. The engineer must understand the chemistry between, say, orange juice and its coated cardboard package, but must also grasp the emotional chemistry between the package and the consumer. In Japan, for example, fish cakes come wrapped in paper that looks like traditional handmade leaves, yet it sports a barcode. The granddaddy of all packagers is Gale Borden. He became interested in packaging food to make it portable after hearing in 1846 of the Donner Party. While traveling west, they became trapped by snow. Only 47% of the original 87 survived, and they did so by eating the others. This gruesome tragedy stirred Borden to action. He first tried to condense the essence of meat into a biscuit. It took 6 years and $60,000 to develop, but failed because it was unsightly and unpalatable. But the idea of condensing fascinated Borden. He advised his pastor to condense your sermons. He told lovers to no longer write poetry, but to condense all they have to say into a kiss. And he suggested you spend as little time as possible at a meal. Borden's next attempt at food packaging came while on an ocean voyage to London. The ship's seasick cows couldn't be milked, so the ship filled with the cries of hungry infants, which spurred him to invent condensed milk. Although experts told him it wouldn't work, Borton put some in a vacuum pan and boiled it. It failed, just as the experts predicted, because it stuck to the pan. Being less knowledgeable than the experts, Borton simply greased the pan and it worked fine to make condensed milk. He canned the product, selling it with the promise of all good packaging, a sanitary and safe product.
And we move from the packaging of food to the content of children's lunchboxes. Up next on Word of Mouth, are brown bag lunches really healthier than cafeteria fare? We'll find out after the news. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. There's been a lot of scrutiny on the health of school cafeteria meals in recent decades, but little to no attention has been paid to the quality of our children's brown bag lunches. Well, researchers recently took a peek inside those bags to find out what the average parent is packing, and the truth isn't exactly appetizing. Boston Globe features writer Beth Tytel wrote about the study and the struggle that parents face when preparing school lunches at home, and she joins us now to put it all on the table. Beth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, I guess we should establish, do you know how many kids bring a lunch from home rather than get one at the school cafeteria?
Well, that's kind of interesting. It turns out that more than 40% of kids bring a lunch.
Wow.
I don't know what statistic on how many kids actually eat those lunches, but yeah, that's actually part of the reason these researchers at Tufts decided to look into it. I mean, as you said, there has been such intense focus on what the school, what the lunch lady is serving. In fact, you know, such a everybody will remember or has heard that the Reagan administration famously characterized ketchup as a vegetable.
Right.
And more recently, our own Congress has pizza counts as a vegetable because of the tomato sauce. But the Tufts people decided to look into what the parents were packing.
Okay, so what did they find then? What did the researchers find when they looked inside those brown paper bags?
Well, actually, it was kind of, I guess to them it was sort of surprising because what they found was that none of the lunches, so they studied lunches at 12 schools, undisclosed schools in the eastern part of Massachusetts, and they discovered that none of the lunches met all five of the National School Lunch Program standards. And those standards emphasize fruits and vegetables and whole grains, low or non-fat dairy. So none of them met all five of those standards, but only 27% of them lunches met at least three of the goals. So they had things in. They said that there was a lot of sugary drinks, like sweetened teas, packaged foods. Apparently there were a lot of, what was it? What did the woman tell me? Oh, a lot of gummy fruit snacks were common, she said. Potato chips, cookies.
Yeah, and that's what kind of kills me is that, you know, I understand that, you know, a parent would want to create a lunch that's, you know, sort of diverse. It's got a little bit of the healthy stuff and maybe a snack, a cookie or something like that. But they also discovered a lot of lunches had only bad snacks. There was literally no entree.
That's right. They said almost one in four lacked an entree, such as a sandwich or leftovers. And instead, they were made up, as you were saying, entirely of packaged snacks and desserts. You know what I find kind of interesting? I have kids myself, so this was actually very, very familiar to me, that it's almost like there's this game of lunch brinksmanship that goes on. Who's going to blink first? Because you have the parents who, most parents want their kids to eat healthy food. But the problem is they're afraid that they're not going to eat anything if they only put the healthy food in. And since they're not standing over them insisting that they do have the carrots or the turkey or whatever they want the kids to eat, they send something else just in case so the child isn't hungry, you know, 9 hours after they return after doing some sports or whatever. But then the kids say they don't have time to eat the healthy food. Somehow it's more time-consuming and only have time for the desserts.
So you think that's probably more of a factor than, say, parents who are rushing in the morning and just don't have time to pack a healthy lunch?
You know, I think, well, I interviewed a sociologist who wrote a book with a great title. It's called It's Not About the Broccoli. And I think the rushing, and she was talking about all the factors that play into it. And what she said was that there was a bunch of things. She said that the goal of nutrition, one, but that's not the only one. She said they don't want their kids to be hungry or they don't want to have a conflict with their kids or they want them to be happy or they've got 12 other kids and other things going on. So I find as a parent, it's not really that packing something healthy takes longer. I think there should be a new unit of time that gets into the psychology of time. It's almost more stressful to be packing something that you know might not be eaten and that might be perishable, so it's going to actually come back. You're putting it in the strawberries, let's say. Then they spend the whole day. They're never eaten. They come back wilted. So even though it might not take longer to wash the strawberries and put them in the Tupperware and give them to your child, it feels like it's longer than putting in some pretzels because the pretzels kind of have a happy, not that you don't want the kids to eat them, but they have almost a happy association since that's going to be success in some way since the child will eat it.
Like you're going to bring your kids joy, but if you give them veggies, it's just a waste.
Right, but yeah, exactly. And this one thing that she said was very interesting. So this is the woman, the author of that book called It's Not About the Broccoli. her name is Dinah Rose. She said that parents make the at least compromise. That's what she called it. She said at least chocolate milk has calcium, at least chicken nuggets have protein. But she said if you think of the cumulative effect of the at least mindset, we're actually teaching our kids the exact opposite habits we want them to have. So she said we're dumbing down their diets and we're pushing their taste buds towards junk and away from healthy food. So it's sort of like you're doing yourself in day by day by day, but each day you're kind of short. Not every parent, of course, but many are short-sighted. Or, you know, this is something I didn't even get into in the article, but it struck me later that, of course, as adults, most people don't have great diets, and some people, in fact, don't even really know what the ideal diet is. It can be confusing. So some parents, I have a feeling, actually don't even know that what they're sending isn't good. Maybe they are actually kind of pleased about it.
Right. We might be just as guilty as that at least mindset as the kids are. So it seems to me, you know, you describe this tug of war, sort of this damned if you do, damned if you don't. You give them vegetables, they don't eat it. You don't give it to them, they don't necessarily get the healthy, well-rounded meal. Well, you even note in your article that there are fewer kids buying these healthier school lunches since those national standards were changed to require more fruits and veggies and less salt and sugar.
You know, that was interesting. That was a study done. You're right. That was a study done by the General Accounting Office in 2012. And yes, in fact, that study found that I think it was a million kids fewer were buying lunches. So that was actually kind of bad for business for the people serving lunches because it was cutting down on business for them. But more recently, a study was done, a smaller study, that found that, in fact, despite initial resistance, more kids actually were accepting these healthy lunches. So it you know, it does make sense in some ways that kids get used to something or they, you know, they get hungry.
They'll so adjust. If they have to adjust, they're going to eat.
They will adjust. And also the thing is, you know, I do think that sociologist made a good point because if fruit, for example, most children can actually find some fruit that they like. I mean, fruit can be just absolutely terrific. So I think it's both things, the parents kind of almost dooming themselves by thinking, oh, she won't eat fruit, when in fact maybe the kid would if that was what they were given.
So any recommendations for the struggling parent? You know, I mean, maybe that recommendation is stop bringing it from home and buy the school lunch.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. That's kind of interesting. The only problem I think is that, right, but you then have to make sure your kid's actually eating the healthy thing at the lunch. Like, they could buy the full lunch that has the salad and the fruit, but then not eat the salad and the fruit. I don't think anyone's looked into it at that level. But the one recommendation I did hear that I thought was good was to if you're making lunch, involve your kids in the lunch decisions. So say, tell me some things you think you'd like to eat. And then you come up with it together. So, and you know, it's a mix. And that way maybe the kid would say, well, I don't want turkey, but I actually really do like hummus. Or so you can maybe hit on something that would be acceptable to the child and also healthy.
Well, Beth Tytel, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's a fun topic.
Beth Tytel is features writer for the Boston Globe. After the interview, Beth and I talked about our memories of the brown bag lunches we packed, or perhaps I should say were packed for us, back in the day.
I grew up, we lived in New York City. When I was 13, we moved from New York to a sort of a waspy town in Connecticut. And my mother made me these really thick roast beef sandwiches. And none of my friends had ever seen a sandwich that thick. Their sandwiches were just this one slice of meat, white bread.
Like, I also remember what I ate for years because I did peanut butter and fluff sandwiches for something like 3 or 4 years in a row every single day.
That's really interesting that as an adult, you have a clear memory often of what you had for school lunch, and yours sounds delicious.
Our conversation about what kids get in their lunches these days also brought back vivid memories for the Word of Mouth team. So we asked a few people at the station if they remembered the lunches of their youth.
My mom packed for me pepperoni as kind of a lunch cold cut. I don't know if that's even a thing still now or ever.
Nothing exotic. I mean, peanut butter sandwich, glass of milk, sort of thing. But I always lived near school, so I would, when it was time for lunch, I would just walk home. And largely that was due to an aversion to the stench of the cafeteria.
I remember it was always a brown bag lunch, always sort of a mushy sandwich in like a little sandwich baggie. And we didn't even get the Ziploc baggies. We had like the fold over baggies, and I just hated those.
There was a branded version of Hi-C, I think it was, Ecto Cooler. And my mom, she would freeze my Ecto Cooler and she would give me a spoon. And so at lunchtime, I would not only have a nice, cool lunch, but I would have an Ecto Cooler slushie every day. It was the best. Thanks, Mom.
And not only thanks to all the moms and dads out there struggling to pack healthy lunches every school day, but thanks to you for listening. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your most memorable brown bag lunches on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott, who will be back in the host seat tomorrow at 2 right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. So don't forget to pack your lunch.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.